Yeah. Okay, so thanks, you guys, for inviting me. And maybe I should say a special thanks, because I'm probably the speaker who knows the least about epilepsy of all the speakers, and probably maybe the least knowledge in this room. But I do know a few things that are that could be related to epilepsy, and one of them is synchronization of oscillators. And what I'm going to be talking about today, I was asked to give a tutorial on this mathematical technique called the theory for weakly coupled oscillators, which is a very powerful dimension reduction technique that can take a large number of oscillators, and that each oscillator could be very complicated, and reduce them down to a single variable for the phase for each oscillator. Okay, but what question we're going to try to answer today, or maybe at least address today, is can this theory provide any insight whatsoever into the mechanisms that underlie epilepsy? I don't have an answer to that question, so the job that I'm going to try to do is to explain the basic ideas that are involved in this theory of weakly coupled oscillators, and then I'm going to, with extensions to the theory, and then I'm going to try to open up discussion in the last 15 minutes or so to get your opinion about is it possible to get any insight whatsoever about epileptic activity using this method. Okay. So a fundamental challenge in neuroscience, as you know, all know, is trying to understand how the intrinsic properties of the neurons, the synaptic dynamics, and the network connectivity all come together to produce activity in the neuronal network, and how this relates to function and dysfunction. So we're thinking about epilepsy here, but also we are thinking also about how activity feeds back onto these properties in this feedback loop. So in specifically for what we're going to be talking about here, we're trying to think about how do these three things combine to produce synchrony in a neural network, and ask the question, does that have anything to do with epileptic activity? So certainly synchronization has something to do with or is involved in epileptic activity. The classical view, I guess, of epilepsy is hyperexcitability and hypersynchrony of a set of neurons. But as Steve Schiff pointed out, it's saying exactly what this means is unclear. Early work that he did, or in 2002 with Tay Netov, started to suggest that it's synchrony is actually stronger in some sense in the interictal periods, and then during the seizure you have some decorrelation of activity, at least on the fast time scales. And this was kind of brought out. They first did it in sliced epileptiform activity, and then people were looking at EEG and I guess local field potentials and seeing similar things. So the upshot of this slide is just to say, yes, synchrony is important in epilepsy, but what synchrony is between different populations is changing as you go through the different periods of the intervals in the epileptic seizure and in ictal periods. Okay, so therefore, we want to try to understand what's happening and how it's happening with a little bit more detail. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about, there's lots of different ways to generate synchrony, and I'm going to restrict this talk to at least the beginning part to synchronization of coupled oscillators. So each neuron you can think about is its own oscillator. And almost all neurons, if you say inject a constant current into them, have the ability of generating periodic oscillations. Or possibly a more physiological way of generating oscillations is raise the extracellular potassium. So not all neurons have the ability to do this, but almost all neurons, you can change the environment in such a way to generate these types of this type of periodic activity. So if we're thinking about synchronization of oscillatory activity like this, we have to define phase. Okay, and phase is just a measure of the timing within the cycle. So if I've got, this is a simulation with a Wang Rinzel model, and it's relaxed down to the model has relaxed down to its limit cycle, and all that phase is just this linear increase in with respect to time. In fact, what I'm taking phase to be is between zero and the period. So this is just has a slope of one. So I'm defining phase of the oscillator to just be a measurement of time within the cycle. And then there's just this extra term right here, which sets the relative phase, and in some sense you can set that to be completely arbitrary. Okay, so one other thing to point out is you can represent the phase of the oscillator as moving around a cycle or a circle going from zero to t, and the when you're on the limit cycle, that progression is perfectly the rate of going around that circle is perfectly constant. So the rate of change in phase I'm taking to be equal to one when you're on the limit cycle, and just as long as you're on that limit cycle, phase is well defined. So you can generate this map that takes x, and that's just some point on the limit cycle. In this case, it was just a two-variable model, v versus h, but it could be any dimensional model, and you can get this map that takes the point and then just maps it to a particular phase. Okay. So the important thing is to remember and to understand this definition of phase. Okay. Just to show you that synchronization isn't always easy to understand, I'm going to show you just a few simulations. So here I've got a I'm going to lie a little bit and tell you that Hodgkin-Huxley type model of 30 neurons that are all coupled through fast excitatory synapses. And how I'm lying is it's not really a Hodgkin-Huxley model, it's a reduced phase model. But if you have excitatory synapses, I hope this is the right one. If you have excitatory synapses, and you've got, in this case, all-to-all connectivity, what you can see is even though they started off at various different phases, as time goes on, the synaptic connectivity is acting to synchronize the phases of all of these guys. They're coming into lockstep. Okay. So that's fast excitatory synapse. But if you use fast inhibitory synapses, I don't know what that's all about, you could start these guys out, spread out over a phase, some uniform like phase distribution, and you could let this simulation run for as long as you want. You'll see no evolution towards a nice synchronous behavior. So so what this is saying is that inhibitory coupling acts to desynchronize and excitatory coupling acts to synchronize. But that's only for fast. Oops, I got to do this, I guess. So that's only for fast synapses. Yes. It's all to all coupling. So a very simple coupling structure here. Okay. But if you do it for slow, if you do it for slow synapses, I won't bother showing you these movies. But for slow synapses, when you have excitatory connections, then instead of going to synchrony when you have excitation, you get a desynchronized state. And when you have inhibitory synapses that are slow, then you've got this behavior goes to a synchronous state. So, yeah, go ahead. This is uniform. So you can relax that, and that's what I'll talk about later. You can relax that to a certain degree and still get synchronous activity. It depends on a lot of things, the actual frequency, all the different parameters of the system, as well as the distribution that the frequencies are coming from. Beg your pardon? Relative to the time constant of the oscillator, or just the period of the oscillation. Yeah. Yeah, I actually forget what I used here, but in these slow guys, it's at least twice the time constant of the synapse is at least twice the length of the period. Okay, so quite slow. Okay. All right. So this was only a demonstration to show you that you get some unexpected activity or synchronization patterns from different networks depending on parameters. So what we saw was that fast synapses in excitatory networks synchronized, and inhibitory networks it desynchronized. Whereas slow synapses seem to have the opposite effect. Okay, but that's not in itself a general rule. It also depends on the specific details of the intrinsic properties. Right, so it's a very complicated problem to figure out all the mechanisms that are going into causing synchronization or desynchronization in even a simple model such as the one I have here with all-to-all coupling and all the same frequencies. Okay, so we want to get some sort of technique that would help us peel apart the mechanisms that are predisposing the network to doing certain things like going to synchrony or not going to synchrony or going to clustered states or so on. Okay, and that's what the theory of weakly coupled oscillators have been used for. Okay, so this is the theory in all its glory here, and what I'm going to try to do is basically unpack this for you in two different ways and then tell you how this could be extended a little bit and finally open it up to a discussion about can this stuff actually help you understand mechanisms of epilepsy. Okay. So as I said before, the idea of this theory is to take it, what it does is takes a possibly very, very complicated network of oscillators. So the individual oscillators can be of very high dimension. They could be multi-compartment models or that have hundreds of different variables. And it'll take each one of those neurons and reduce the neuron dynamics to an equation for the phase of each one of those guys. So if you have n oscillators, instead of n times 100 different variables, you can reduce it down to just the simple network of equations. Okay. So before I actually tell you how this is derived, I'm going to show you one example of how it can be very useful. And I put this little reminder down here to say through these derivations that I'm going to be talking about, there's two main ideas, or just one main idea that this theory is based on, and that's just the idea of linearity and superposition. All right, so if you had just two cells, then you could get these two so-called phase models. So the rate of change of this variable theta 1, it's the relative phase of the first oscillator here, is just given by this function right here, which only depends on the phase difference between these two cells. And the same sort of thing for this other cell. So you get two identical cells with identical coupling. If you have that, then you can define the phase difference here, take the difference between these two differential equations, and you have a scalar differential equation that only depends on this variable of the phase difference. So when you get that, all you have to do is plot that function, and that tells you everything about the synchronization properties that you want to know. So the zeros of this G function here are the phase lock states. So for this particular G function, you have a steady state at synchrony, which is T phase is equal to zero, and also antiphase, phase is equal to 0.5 when it's normalized by the period. And then the synchronous state here up at 1 is really the same state as that because we've got a periodic function here. Okay. Furthermore, the slopes you can see at the fixed points here, the steady states, give you the stability of the steady state, right? Because if G is positive up here, you know that the phi dt is positive, and therefore phi is going to increase, and it's going to move towards the synchronous state. Whereas if G is negative down here, what's going to happen? Well, d phi dt is negative, so therefore it decreases and asymptotically approaches the synchronous steady state. So immediately, you just look at that G function, and you could say, oh, I've got two phase lock states, synchrony and antiphase, and I know the synchronous one is the stable one. So that's what the system will progress to, as time goes on. Okay. So how do we actually get these this G function or the H function that I showed you? Well, the first way to think about deriving the theory, I'm gonna it's gonna be thinking about something called the phase response curves, which many of you have heard of, as an impulse response function or a Green's function for the system. Okay. So it's gonna be in just a few steps. So let's just try to follow each one of the steps, and hopefully it'll make sense. So the idea is, so I'm just gonna deal with the two oscillator case. There you have two neurons that will have coupling soon. But right now I'm saying that they're decoupled, and I'm gonna consider each one of them separately. So let's say you've got some Hodgkin-Huxley type model for each one of these cells, and that can include, you know, as many recovery variables as you want, and also even some synaptic dynamics as well. Okay. So if this system has a periodic limit cycle, or it has a limit cycle of period T, then you can write, you can think about knowing the function VLC, which describes that periodic motion. And so I'm thinking about this as just this function as a function of time. But you also have this periodic activity for all W's and also your synaptic variable S. So each one of those variables you can think of as having an SLC and so on. Okay. This right in here, T plus theta J, notice that is exactly what the phase is. That's psi. And then this right here was the relative phase. So if you have two uncoupled cells, you start them off at arbitrary initial conditions that lead to this periodic activity, then these two things will be generally different. But the oscillations will be the same, but then the phase difference will be shifted and completely arbitrary if they're uncoupled. Okay. So now let's think about two cells that now have coupling. Okay, so we can add the coupling term here to the current balance equation. But let's think about this coupling as being fairly weak. So if this is weak, then it's not going to perturb the dynamics of the system all that much. So you still have an asymptotically stable limit cycle, so your voltages and all your other variables will pretty much be similar to what they were in the isolated cell case. Okay? But this phase here, the relative phase of the cells, can be shifted a little bit forward or shifted a little bit backward at every cycle, right? So what this extra current is doing is just pushing you along a little bit faster around the limit cycle or slowing you down a little bit, okay? And what we're going to try to do is try to get an equation for that relative phase, okay? So think about you're adhering to the limit cycle, but the coupling is just pushing you forward, speeding you up, or slowing you down as you move around that limit cycle, okay? To understand, to get that equation for the relative phase, you have to think about this thing called the phase response curve. So the phase response curve is just, it can be measured by taking the individual oscillator and then perturbing it at a particular phase, right? So here you're perturbing at some point in the cycle, some phase, and instead of going on the blue curve, what you've done is advanced the firing. You've advanced the phase of the cell along this red curve. So you take that phase advance and you can plot it as a function of the timing with which you gave that stimulus. And the stimulus I'm taking to be small and delta function-like. It's actually going to be, or in this case, a little square pulse of a particular small brief duration and a small amplitude. So you do this for lots and lots of different phases along in this period, and you're going to sculpt out a particular curve. This is the phase response curve. It's plotting the phase shift as a function of the timing at which you stimulate the cell and its oscillation. Okay. The infinitesimal phase response curve just takes that phase response curve and normalizes it by the amplitude of the stimulations. And by amplitude, I mean the amplitude of the stimulus times the time. So that's basically the net charge. And what I've left out here is there's there's also it's normalized by its capacitance too. Okay, so the infinitesimal phase response curve is just the phase response curve generated by a small pulse normalized by the amplitude of that pulse. Okay, so this is basically, so you got the phase shift divided by the amplitude here is equal to this function, the infinitesimal phase response curve, Z. Okay, so we're going to take that curve, that equation, and try to rearrange it to get some sort of pseudo-differential equation, right? So you can see if you bring the stimulus to the other side, we're going to get this equation. So this looks kind of like a differential equation, but really it's only for a single small pulse. So now we make the key assumption. So we're going to assume that if you give multiple pulses, this equation right here gives us a way to linearly add up all the phase shifts of all those different pulses. And if you think about not separated pulses, but fuse those pulses together, so you have a continuous input, then what that basically tells you is you can change this into a differential equation where this perturbing stimulus is always going to be changing, and the relative phase basically just does a convolution of the phase response curve with that stimulus at any given through time. Okay, so the idea here is linearity, right? You're doing a superposition of all of the input that you're giving. Okay. And this is just a kind of a slick way of writing it down. Okay, so what does that tell us for our two-cell case? Well, in the two-cell case, what is the perturbing stimulus? It's the stimulus coming for the synaptic current coming from the other cell. So we can get the evolution of the phase of this guy, the relative phase of this guy, by just convolving the phase response curve with the input coming in from this other cell right here. And you have a similar equation for cell two. Okay, so this is what your coupling current would be. All right. So this, you've already simplified things down to the so-called phase model, right? So now you've taken a possible 10-dimensional cell and you've reduced it down to the dynamics down to a single variable for that cell. But this differential equation is non-autonomous, right? It's got explicit time dependence here. Each one of the thetas are time dependent, but you also have these t's here. So that's a little bit unwieldy, but we can get rid of them by averaging over the right-hand side. The idea here is that z is a periodic function, a capital T periodic function. And these guys are also T periodic functions, right? They're generated from the limit cycle. Okay? So you've got T periodic, but the coupling, I'm assuming, is very weak. So this scales this right-hand side, the G sin, that's small. So therefore, theta is changing very slowly. So over a single cycle, theta barely changes at all. So what you can do is say, well, I'm going to take this right here, and I'm going to assume that theta is constant over a single cycle, and then take the average of over that cycle. So here I've taken Z and I, and held this fixed, so this is now a function of t, but these guys are a function of some faster timescale t tilde, and I've averaged that over a full period. Okay. So once you have that, you can just reorder. You can do a little change of variables, and you can get it down to this thing right here. And the important thing there is that you're able to get this right-hand side here as a function of just the phase difference between the two cells. So now you've got your phase model that you're after. The rate of change of theta j is just equal to some function, and you have to solve for each one of these guys and take that integral, but you can get that function, and it's a function of the phase difference between the two cells, so now you've got a substantial reduction in your system. Let's see. What time did I start at? I just want to know if I should go through this. What's that? 240. 240, yeah, okay. All right. So let me quickly go through a different derivation. This is a little bit more mathematical, but it gives more insight, I think, for people who have some a geometric for the people that are able to picture the geometry in their head. Okay. So let's think about this system, the Hodgkin-Huxley-like system, but now I'm just saying x is some vector, so that's v, m, h, and n. And we've got this periodic, t-periodic limit cycle that we're talking about. And here's their definition of phase. So everything as we started before, just a little bit more abstract notation there. Okay. So as I said before, for points on the limit cycle, there's this map that takes that given point and gives you the phase. Okay, so that's just this equation right here. So notice if I take the derivative of this guy with respect to t, I'll get d psi dt, right? And then I take the derivative of this guy where x now is a function of time, and I use the chain rule, I'll get this right here, okay? But I know that d psi dt on the limit cycle is equal to 1. So now what that gives me is that the gradient of this map evaluated along the limit cycle times this vector function here evaluated on that limit cycle at the same point is equal to 1. Okay, so that's just a definition of phase, basically. Okay, so what does that give you? Well, to see what it gives you, we have to define phase off of the limit cycle as well. So we're going to generate this thing called, this idea called asymptotic phase. So when you start at an initial condition right on the limit cycle, we know what that phase is because you actually do have periodic behavior. But what's the phase of this point up here? There's no well-defined definition of that phase because it's not part of your cyclic behavior. But what you can say is, I'm going to take this phase to be the same as this guy if, as time goes on, they asymptotically approach one another. So let's say after 10 milliseconds, they were like this, and after a little while longer, 20 milliseconds, they were like this. And as time went on, they were converging to the exact same point with the same timing along the limit cycle. So we say that those two things have the same asymptotic phase. So then you can say, well, if these two points have the same asymptotic phase, I can do the same thing for many points, and you can map out a curve where every single point along that curve has the same asymptotic phase. So you can call this asymptotic phase phi0, and you can do that for every single point in the basin of attraction of this limit cycle, and you generate these lines called isochrons. They're lines of equal asymptotic phase. Okay. What that allows you to do is extend, remember we had this equation right here, right? This allows you to extend this definition right here to not only points along the limit cycle, but to any other point in the basin of attraction of the limit cycle. Okay. All right. So now what we'll do is, so that was just for the single cell, unperturbed cell. We can say now we're going to take this oscillator, and we're going to couple to another oscillator, but only weakly. This little epsilon here is some small parameter to say the coupling is weak. Okay. So what we can do is make the exact same change of variables as we did when we were considering a single oscillator, and that is just this. We're going to take x and change the variables into the phase psi. Okay. So when we do that, we can take the derivative of this and get this relationship. But now this dx dt is not just equal to f, it's equal to f plus this perturbation here. So if we plug that into here, we get this, and we can expand that to get this right here. So this right here, by definition, was equal to 1, right? So that's the unperturbed system. That corresponds to the vector field of the unperturbed system. But then the perturbed system effects are all captured in this term right here. So this was equal to 1, and therefore, we get this equation for the phase. So when epsilon 0, that we have no coupling, it's just d psi dt is equal to 1. Motion around the limit cycle at a constant rate, right? This is what captures the effect of the coupling. And so far, I have not made a single assumption about what's going on. I just made a change of variables. So now I'm going to make the change of variables. Okay. So I'm going to. Oh, sorry. One more thing is I'm going to change this to be relative phase. Remember, relative phase was just so psi was equal to t plus the relative phase. The change of variables here will give you this. Basically, just gets rid of that one. Okay. All right. So now we've got this equation here. We can say since epsilon is very small, I have the approximation that x is always very close to your limit cycle. So therefore, in first order approximation is that it is on the limit cycle and the state is given by its phase. We take that, plug it into our equation, and we basically get to the point that we were from the previous definition. This here and this here are periodic functions. This is small, so we can do the averaging over a given period, and we get the h function from before. Okay. So this is the form in this new form, and I just want you to to notice that this right this position right here is where the function z was before the IPRC, the infinitesimal phase response curve. So what is that in this case? Well, it's the gradient of the isochronal map. So what is that, right? So if you've got just perturbation in your first equation, your V equation, then the only part of this this gradient that matters is the first component, d phi dv. What is that? That's the slope of the isochronal field in the direction of V. So it's the sensitivity of the system, of the phase of the system, to perturbations in the V direction. That's all the infinitesimal PRC is. And that's why a lot of people like to call this the phase sensitivity function. Okay. All right. So what good is this in general? Well, why I like it is, as I was saying before, this theory gives you a way to peel apart the mechanisms that lead to some particular synchronization properties. So if you know what the shape of Z is, and you know what the shape of your synaptic input are, then you can calculate what this G function is, and as I said, you know, once you got your G function, you know all the synchronization properties of the system. Okay. But if you want to get to the biophysical mechanisms of what causes synchrony and what doesn't, when you've got this form for this equation right here, you can just break down the idea of figuring out what the biophysical mechanisms are by reducing it to the questions, how does one particular type of current change the shape of your PRC, or how does it change the I? Okay, and those two things are much easier to do than just immediately go to synchronization properties. So it gives you a way to dissect out the biophysical mechanisms that lead to the synchronization properties. Okay, so for one example, this is from Tay Netov's lab. He was testing the effects of this anti-epileptic drug. So he had a particular cell from the hippocampus that he got to oscillate regularly, and then he generated the phase response curves for a few cells, fit them to particular curves, and then used the theory of weakly coupled oscillators to assess what the changes in the shape of this phase response curve due to the anti-epileptic drug did to the synchronization properties. And what he found was for this case, for these cells, it shifted the point where the system went from a synchronous to an asynchronous state further up into the frequency zone. So this is the current that he's injecting into the cell, and the point where you make a transition from synchronous to asynchrony is shifted over here with the anti-epileptic drug. Okay. So that's the That's why I like it. So now let's try to think about, well, if I want to extend this theory to be relevant to epilepsy, you have to think about a bunch of things, three of which are, well, you've got a lot of heterogeneity in the cortex, you've got a lot of noise, and you're not dealing with just one or two cells, you're dealing with a whole mass of cells. And there are ways to extend this theory to account for all of these situations, just as long as you have sufficiently weak heterogeneity, sufficiently weak noise, and both of these for the large networks. Okay, so maybe I'll just kind of quickly go through this. If you any heterogeneity in intrinsic properties will lead to a term like this that's added to your phase model. Okay, so this is a measure of the heterogeneity here, delta I. Epsilon is the strength of this heterogeneity, and then z average is just the average of the phase response curve. Okay. Once you have this, you can easily figure out where your new phase lock states are for that weak level of heterogeneity. So if there's your g function here, if I have some particular level of heterogeneity, you can basically shift the zero to up here. And now you've got two new zeros. That gives you your new phase lock states, and you can read off that this one's unstable and this one's stable. So almost synchrony is stable here. And you can increase the level of heterogeneity, and eventually what you'll get is no intersections between your G function and your line representing this thing right here. And that says you don't have any more phase lock states. What you do have phase drift. So the system will peer phase lock for a while and then drift out and peer phase lock for a while and so on. Yeah.
What is missing here is excitability considerations in that to assume that this weakly coupled system will synchronize, you still need conditions for that entrainment. And those conditions will take into account something else. That's why the phase oscillator model by itself does not take into account what would have been in the dynamics of, say, R dot, some other variable.
You mean, so amplitude, you think about amplitude.
So that you would deal with the issue of saying entrainment by itself shouldn't be given. The moment you talk about heterogeneity, then this notion of entrainment and frequency pulling and whatever else comes about is open. So you cannot make the assumption that you will have
just as long as your heterogeneity is sufficiently weak, this is perfectly valid. The question is, in any neural network, what does sufficiently weak mean, and does that hold for the actual system you're trying to model? And that's why I'm saying I have no answer. Yeah, and naturally that would occur, but it has to be small. So you give me any heterogeneity, I can plug it into the model. Just as long as it's weak, it's going to pop out as a term like this, and then you can analyze it like this. But the question is it? Okay. Well, let me kind of skip over a bunch of stuff and cut to the chase. So this is, I just wanted to point out, you can extend this to weak noise and get cross-correlograms for two cells. You can extend it to large networks and do some averaging if you have certain statistical properties of your connectivity. But one thing I wanted to point out, but coupling has to be weak. So what people do when they analyze large networks is you can have lots of different intrinsic phases or intrinsic frequencies, but the strength of the total coupling is always they always scale it by the number of inputs that you have, and that's to keep it weak, right? So if you didn't do that, and M was high, then this could soon run out of control, and you'd no longer be in the weak coupling regime, which is a big problem with the theory. Okay. So So there's good extensions for this, which I kind of flashed over. There's also a good extension. You can take two different populations and do this theory, but to apply it, they have to have similar periods. They don't have to have the same periods, but similar periods. Coupling doesn't have to be on the soma. It can be anywhere. As I said, you could do this dimension reduction for multi-compartment models as well. Synaptic plasticity, no problem. The main thing is that all of these guys, the coupling, the perturbation always has to be sufficiently small. So what is sufficiently small, small is the big question, okay? So quantitatively, what it means is that this perturbation here is always an order of magnitude smaller than the intrinsic dynamics. So for systems that we care about, Hodgkin-Huxley-like models, the synaptic current in total from all of the other cells has to be always an order of magnitude smaller than the intrinsic membrane current in order for this theory to be quantitatively accurate. Okay. But that doesn't mean that it can't give insight into the into systems qualitatively. Often, if you take two cells, extend the system to many cells, what you find in two cells often carries over into many cells. So the basic are the cells synchronizing or do they go out of phase carries over to the large network case, as well as you slowly increase the strength of the coupling. You start weak, increase. Eventually, it's going to break down. But it actually holds, the qualitative results hold considerably well for intermediate strength of coupling. So you can still get some insight by doing this analysis. Okay. So there's lots and lots of problems with it, but you still might get some insight. Perhaps another problem with with using this theory is an interesting setting, are neurons actually oscillators? Sometimes they look like they're firing periodically, but the period is varying all over the place, so it's not clear. Okay, so maybe what I'll do now is just stop there, and since I started about 10 minutes late, I want to open up to the audience and try to get a sense for what you guys think. Is this a reasonable method to use, or is there so many fundamental flaws in it that we shouldn't even bother considering?
Yeah, I would still raise my concern about excitability. Phase dynamics are important, but so are excitability dynamics.
So what do you mean by excitability?
I want to see that, okay, there is, for instance, the Flinsky terms, Flinsky R dot and phi dot, and both of them are functions of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then the shape of the R dot dynamic will make a lot of impact on what phi dot is.
So in terms of R, you mean distance away from the limit cycle? Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. So there are methods to get R dot, but they're very, very, they're quite difficult. Yeah.
I think, from my angle at least, it's important enough in the neuronal world that we cannot let it go.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, it's difficult. Just to give an example, when I was studying my grad work, I started like everybody else in phase oscillators, but quickly moved out into this, when I recognized the importance of excitability.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I could possibly defend it by saying, okay, yes, we're not. So this is a highly idealized model, right? So if we're just looking for general properties, Maybe, what's that? Yeah, okay.
Getting back into epilepsy, because epilepsy is being thought of as a hyper-excitability, yeah, as the major push towards various models of epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So there, almost excitability is almost defining that particular state.
Yeah.
So I should read as well, talk about.
So I didn't want to give this away beforehand, but I 100% agree with you. I don't think this is a good way to study full-blown the epileptic activity. Absolutely, positively not. Especially because you've got tons of different ways to think about synchronization, right? So you could even ask, is a seizure or a bunch of neuronal oscillators falling into synchrony? Whether you include R or not. Yes. Okay. So there's so many other ways that things can synchronize, like common input, feed forward actors, this is basically the same thing. Feed forward networks will synchronize. If you've got spiral wave like patterns that could generate into lots of other reentrant activities. Oh, yeah. I think there's lots of applications for the theory of weak coupled oscillators, but I don't believe that it's relevant to modeling seizures. What it might be good at doing is trying to pick apart some of the elements of the anti-epileptic drugs. I know I was asked to give a tutorial on the theory of weak coupled oscillators. I'll let you guys talk about that. So in neuroscience, everyone says, "Oh, the phase response curve is a response to a current injection, right?" And that's because they think about, which is a non-physiological stimulus in certain ways. So if you've got your Hodgkin-Huxley equation, you've got your current balance law, right? The coupling almost always appears as this added current, okay? So just as long as your perturbation is in that current balance law and your perturbation is sufficiently weak, then that's perfectly fine. But if you're somehow perturbing the gating variable of your potassium, right, that's going to give you a completely different phase response curve. Right? And in general, notice that when I did the general theory, the phase response curve was this gradient of a vector, of a function of many variables. So this is a vector. Each one of the elements is a phase response curve. But if this is only a current that's perturbing the current equation, right, the voltage equation, then the only element of this that matters is the dV equation. And this is the one that's typically, that is always measured, because in some sense that's the only one that we can to get at very easily. Right. So just as long as it's a current, it's perfectly fine. Maybe you didn't understand my answer.
With a physiological waveform,
Oh, okay. So, so I thought it was more, it wasn't a current input, it was a conductance input. So that's actually not a problem either, because when you do the convolution, that takes care of the different shapes of the synaptic input. So this is good for slow, fast, and any kind of input, gap junctional connections. Just as long as the connection is weak, this convolution here with the IPRC, so this is acting like an impulse response function from linear systems theory, or a Green's function. So to get the total effect of any kind of input, you just have to take the convolution of that input with this input response function, and you'll get the right phase shifts. Yeah. So that's again that the issue is an issue of what's sufficiently weak. Okay. So if I was to measure my phase response curve, let's call this ZE. So the infinitesimal phase response curve, or sorry, a phase response curve for excitatory input. And let's say we got that. If you use the same amplitude of the current but make it inhibitory, you're going to get that. If you have the current but made it still excitatory, you'll get that. So the idea is it's responding linearly if you give the perturbations sufficiently small. So now if you took a stimulus that was, so say this was for delta function-like stimuli, and you gave a stimulus like this, well, to get the effect of this type of stimulus, so this is time and your synaptic current, you take this curve, convolve it with this shape, and then you'll get the right total phase response curve, not the infinitesimal phase response curve. Okay, did I answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, it'll have a different.
Yep.
Yeah, so you can get a different PRC for each one, just as long as the period is similar. Oh, so it will just change this function right here. So it won't be symmetric anymore. So I should have gone way back to where H was. This will be this will have a J here, right? So H will be different for each neuron. If the periods are very different and not harmonics of one another, then you can't use this to this theory to account for that. But just as long as they have similar enough period, you can get your PRCs for each one of your cells, generate the network, and apply.